Hello, and welcome to the 16th episode of Orthodoxy, Autocracy, and Nationality, a failed Byzantine restoration, how the Ottoman Empire survived the 18th century. Now, I approached this topic with a little bit of trepidation because of the rather depressing state of the historiography and the English language surrounding this. And of course, I'm approaching this from English. I cannot speak Turkish. I cannot speak Greek, unfortunately. Nevertheless, occasionally, when I'm really trying to sort out or understand a period, I go around various, articles, books, sometimes just the Wikipedia entry, just to see what this period is called. And the Wikipedia entry has changed quite a lot over the last sort of decade. At the moment, they're calling this period between 1700 and 1789 the Ancien regime for the Turkish Empire, for the Ottoman Empire. And that doesn't mean anything. That's a completely useless, redundant point of periodization, which informs us nothing about this era, about its implications. And moreover, the dating is wrong. It just conforms with that of the French Ancien regime, which is also a topic which I'm going to tackle next week, and the viability of that concept of an Ancien regime. So obviously then, if one doesn't take that angle, one goes to the classic route of decline. Then one has to recall that the Ottoman Empire in 1683 was not only a great power, it was probably the greatest land power in Europe and the greatest naval power in the Mediterranean. So it wasn't just a great power, it was one of the greatest powers in the world. Then also compare that with Poland. By the end of the 18th century, so in the year 1800, the Ottoman Empire had, if you look at a map, retained most of its territory. And if you look at a map of Poland and Lithuania had ceased to exist as a state. So, by all accounts, the Ottoman Empire actually did pretty well. It did pretty well when contrasting against other great empires of the time, namely Spain. So, I do tend to wonder again how it is sort of viable for me to employ this use of the term decline. It is a useful metric, but it is not the dominating metric, which I find useful in understanding this period. We've also talked about the idea of an Ottoman decline on our previous stream called A Sultanate of Women question mark, where we're really going over this idea as to whether contemporaries thought that the Ottoman Empire was going over decline. And in that topic, we were discussing how there was a real palpable feeling of decline. There was a political transformation, and then there was a restoration. So again, I come to this notion rather less of how the Ottoman Empire declined, but how remarkable it was that the empire survived with most of its limbs intact against all the odds, because during this time, the Ottoman Empire didn't have any great leaders, no great sultans of note. And it was facing domestic rebellions almost continuously, and it faced at times almost universal opposition from Europe's great powers. So, in that context, I thought survival was a much better and more interesting metric. And then I was thinking, okay, survival. So, what were the plans to dismember the Ottoman Empire? The most real plan in terms of this period, which we will be getting into, is the Greek project or the Greek plan of Grigory Potemkin and Catherine the Great of Russia, this idea of parceling out the European possessions of the Ottoman Empire with its capital of Constantinople and giving it to Catherine the Great's second grandson, Constantine. So that is one idea of how the Ottoman Empire could not have survived the 18th century, how there was a very real possibility, I believe, of a Byzantine restoration in the end of the 18th century. But then it dawned on me that this idea of a Byzantine restoration had broad implications to this idea of the militarum, or the nation of Rome, within the Ottoman Empire, and the rise of the Phanerites, or the Phanerites, the Greek mercantile aristocracy from the Greek quarter in Constantinople, who came to dominate the empire intellectually, politically, and culturally during the 18th century, and how that then segues into Greek independence later on. So, in that sense, the Ottoman Empire itself was witnessing its own Byzantine restoration that failed in part as a result of the Russian Empire trying to instigate its own form of Byzantine restoration. I hope this will become clear as I get into this topic more. But then I also looked at the territorial losses and gains of the Ottoman Empire during this picture, and it's definitely not clear. You look, you know, you tend to remember 1683, you tend to remember the Great Turkish War, you tend to remember the fact that the Ottoman Empire lost Hungary, you tend to remember the fact that the Ottoman Empire lost Crimea, but you forget the fact that the Ottoman Empire lost the Morea and then very quickly took it back, the fact that the empire lost Belgrade and then very quickly took it back, how they lost Egypt and somewhat were able to take it back, but that's more complicated. And I couldn't help but feel linking this back to this idea of a failed Byzantine restoration, that this idea of losing territory and then recovering tentatively, losing more territory and recovering, was very reminiscent of the Byzantine Empire, especially during the 12th and the 13th centuries. So in all this respect, I believe that the title, A Failed Byzantine Restoration, How the Ottoman Empire Survived the 18th Century, was a much more interesting metric, but not just interesting in the sake it makes for a good narrative, but also a correct understanding of this period, because decline and this whole idea that the Ottoman Empire was a waning state fails to take into account the fundamental durability of the Ottoman Empire when you compare it against its opponent and former great power rival Poland and Lithuania. So really the comparative network has really helped me out in understanding this period, and it is without, you know, any more sort of delays and my rambling on introduction that we'll get on to actually what happens. Now, I have two maps here. The first map is the Ottoman Empire at its height following the end of the so-called earlier period of decline. And then we have the Kapuli Restoration. And the map I have later is some 40 years later, following the second greater Austro-Turkish War from 1716 to 1718, whereby the Ottomans have now lost Belgrade. Albeit that isn't a complete picture either. I also have these maps referring to the Holy League and referring to the gains of the Holy League and later losses of the Holy League. But it's almost universally considered that this idea of Ottoman decline, or when the Ottoman Empire could be considered terminal in some respect, is often dated the beginning of 1683. So let's start with 1683 and try and tease out an understanding from there. So this great idea, I've termed it the Great Turkish Disaster or the Great Turkish War, was preceded by this Kapuli Restoration under, of course, it was inaugurated under the end of this period of the Sultanate of Women. So you have the Velide Sultan Turhan and her son Mehmed IV. They were able to arrest the decline of the empire, and they were able to ensure a return of a economic, military, and moral recovery before witnessing the greatest setback in the empire's history, far exceeding that of Lepanto, far exceeding that of the First Siege of Vienna, far exceeding that of the Malta. And these, if anything, only stymied the Ottoman, the expansion of the Ottoman Empire and shattered the illusion of Ottoman invincibility, as opposed to this, which breaks the idea of the Ottoman Empire as a supreme sort of land power, at least. In the decade before 1683, the Ottoman Empire had advanced into Podolia and Poland before attacking Russia under the guise of protecting the Cossacks. Since 1526, Hungary had ceased to exist as a viable independent state, coming under the rule of the Austrian Habsburgs in the west as rural Hungary and the Transylvanian Principality in the east as an Ottoman vassal. Territory had consistently changed hands between the Habsburgs and the Ottomans since the Ottomans failed to capture Vienna in 1529. Nevertheless, by 1681, the Ottoman position in Hungary was formidable. In addition to their vassal of Transylvania, the Ottomans directly administered central Hungary as the Eyalets, or the provinces of Budin, Budapest, Egri or Eger, Varat, Temesvar and Kanizsé. To compound the woes of the Habsburgs in Hungary, they faced an ongoing insurgency from the Kurush, or literally from linguistically, it's from the Turkish Kurudush, although it's sometimes referred to as Kuruç, meaning from the cross, literally meaning in Turkish insurgent. The grievances of these insurgents lay in the fact that many were Protestant, many were disaffected Magyar nobility, and they were frustrated with the counter-reformation Catholic policies and the absolutist policies of the Holy Roman Emperor, who was also the King of Hungary, Leopold I. In 1681, a Hungarian noble called Imre Tokoli declared himself King of Upper Hungary. And now this is a region called Felvidek, which later become part of Eastern Slovakia. and as king of Upper Hungary, Thakoli received Ottoman recognition and support. Virtually all the lands of ancient Hungary, which is referred to as the lands of St. Stephen, save for Pressburg, modern-day Bratislava, and its environs were now under the direct or indirect rule of the Ottoman Empire in Constantinople. As the Hungarian rebels and the Ottomans had become allies, it was impossible for the Habsburgs to mount any sort of counterattack against the Hungarian rebels without provoking the latter into some sort of conflict, as the Habsburg incursions into Ottoman Hungary necessarily provided the pretext for the then Grand Vizier of the Ottoman Empire, Kalam Mustafa Pasha, to attack Vienna and realize the unfulfilled ambition of Suleiman the Magnificent. The 50-month gap between mobilization and invasion, delayed by the prospect of a possible winter campaign for the Ottomans, gave Leopold ample time to convene an alliance of German states and Poland. Nevertheless, when confronted by an Ottoman Crimean-Hungarian army of some 150,000 men, Emperor Leopold fled from the city of Vienna, and the city's defences were handed over to Ernst von Starhemberg, with the support ultimately of Jan Sobieski of Poland. By August of 1683, the city was surrounded. Nevertheless, the head of the Austrian armies, Charles Duke of Lorraine, had defeated the Ottoman-aligned Hungarians under Thakoli north of Vienna. France exploited the situation to extend its claims on the Holy Roman Empire, anticipating a devastating war for the Habsburgs that would leave Western Germany ripe for French conquest. By September 8th, Ottoman sappers had destroyed part of the city walls and finally occupied the lower walls around the Burg Revelin, while the Polish army of 80,000 men had finally arrived. Kala Mustafa, meanwhile, had alienated his Wallachian, Transylvanian, Romanian, and Crimean allies by placing them between the Ottoman siege force to bear the full brunt of Sobieski's relief attack. The Crimeans refused to attack the Poles, while the Moldovan prince was quickly captured by Sobieski. On the 12th of September 1683, Sobieski's army was camped on the heights of the Kahlenberg. The troops within the city, informed of the Polish arrival, successfully operated in tandem with the relief force, pushing back the Ottoman positions to the wall of Vienna. Nevertheless, they were unable to break through the Ottoman lines. The Polish had now advanced to Gestov and employed the Polish hussars for the first time. The Ottoman army itself began melting away, with Kara Mustafa himself retreating from the battlefield before the decisive charge of some 18,000 Polish cavalry, led by 3,000 winged hussars at 6 p.m., possibly the largest cavalry charge in the history of warfare. Within hours, the Catholic forces had defeated the Ottoman besiegers completely. Starhemberg had anticipated another Ottoman attack and hurried to rebuild the walls before another offensive led by Kara Mustafa Pasha, although this never came. And this is a repeating remark that the Austrians and the Polish were always overestimating the Ottoman response. They couldn't believe that the Ottomans were defeated so easily. The Ottomans retreated into Hungary, while Mehmed IV ordered Kara Mustafa Pasha to be strangled in Belgrade, and it would seem that this would terminate the Kapulu era. Vienna had stalled the Ottoman advance into Europe yet again, but what differentiated the battle from the previous Habsburg-Turkish battles was the willingness of a large coalition to exploit the victory and reverse centuries of Ottoman gains in Europe. The first such follow-up victory was at Pakani, where Sobieski defeated the Ottomans in West Hungary and took the vital city of Esztergom. By the beginning of 1684, Innocent the Pope, sorry, I just need to get this map up for you to illustrate this, elevated the alliance signed by the Treaty of Warsaw prior to the siege. So this is the alliance between the Holy Roman Emperor and the Polish just to defend against the Ottomans. The Pope elevates this to a Holy League in defense of Christendom. The Pope's answer to what he believed was still the existential threat of an Ottoman attack and invasion of Europe. The significance of this idea of a Holy League is manifold. First, Venice was brought into the offensive against the Ottomans, alongside Austria and her German allies in Poland. Moreover, the League members were to continue their exclusive campaign against the Ottomans collectively, barring any individual member from signing a separate peace. Finally, the Pope recognized any territorial gains individual members should acquire against the Ottomans, save a Venice, which was promised the return of all territories in Dalmatia. France attempted to break the league, fearing the implications of major gains of his Catholic rivals against, this is Louis XIV, of his major Catholic rivals against France's traditional ally, the Ottomans. Moreover, the threat of the league should it be directed against France. The Great Turkish War is sometimes dubbed a crusade, in keeping with the early anti-Ottoman crusades of Nicopolis and Varna. Nevertheless, the main Catholic powers and their smaller Protestant allies were joined by Orthodox Russia in 1686, who had concluded their eternal peace with Poland, while Innocent XI successfully induced Safavid Persia to send an expeditionary force against the Ottomans on the Eastern Front. The League rushed to take Buda, but failed in the first attempt. Of course, Budapest has yet to be formed. We are still talking about Buda and Pest. In 1686, a Turkish relief army, led by the new Grand Vizier Salih Suleiman Pasha, failed to relieve the siege, and the city fell to the Habsburgs for the first time in 143 years. As the Turks had put up fierce resistance to the Holy League forces under their leader Abde Pasha, the city was plundered, and those linked to the Ottoman defence efforts, namely Muslims and Jews, were massacred. The Ottoman reverses in Hungary were confirmed by their defeat at the Second Battle of Mohács the following year to undo the disaster of the original Battle of Mohács in 1526. The Austrians gained core Hungary, in addition to Croatian Slavonia, Transylvania. The Habsburgs, moreover, were quick to confirm their indisputable claim of rulership to the whole of Hungary, so that no Hungarian contender, ally to the Ottomans, could covet the throne again, as had been the case over the previous century and a half, beginning with John Sepoya. Regardless, the rebellion against Habsburg rule that had facilitated the Ottomans prior to the siege of Vienna continued piecemeal until 1711, reaching height in 1705. Parts of the Ottoman Empire, after this colossal defeat at the Second Battle of Mohács, begin to mutiny, and Salih Suleiman Pasha fled first to Belgrade and then Constantinople, while the remnants of the army collapsed around him. Upon his return, the Grand Vizier was executed by Mehmet IV. Even Mehmet IV would not survive this calamity, having lost the support of the army and the Yanisheris, and he was deposed and replaced by his brother Suleiman II. A rebellion had broken out in Serbia, with various militias supporting the Habsburgs. They now advanced down into the Danube unimpeded. Interestingly to note that the Austrians, the Serbians, were fast friends at this time. In the case of Maximilian II of Bavaria and Eugene of Savoy, Maximilian, of course, would play a later role in the Royal Spanish Succession, if you do check that out, took the city of Belgrade, the key Ottoman fortress in the Balkans, leaving the road to Constantinople open. The Venetians, meanwhile, had begun attacking the Ottoman-controlled Ionian Islands before invading Greece itself, taking Preveso and Vonica, supported, as with the Austrians and Serbia, by Greek militias. In 1685, the Venetians invaded the Morea, precipitating a rebellion against the Ottomans throughout the Peloponnese, while the Venetians took the crucial Mani Peninsula, repulsing many Ottoman counterattacks. The Venetians, under Morosini, then took Patras to take control of the Corinthian Gulf, essentially the little isthmus which separates mainland Greece with the Peloponnese Peninsula. With the fall of Mystra and Corinth, the two major cities in the Peloponnese, the whole Peloponnese came under the control of the Venetians, and Morosini, the Venetian admiral, was declared Peloponnesiacus, or essentially the victor or the conqueror of the Peloponnese. After Vienna and Bacchani, Polish advances were relatively modest compared to the Habsburgs and the Venetians. An attack into Moldavia failed, after which the Polish focused on retaking the crucial fortress of Kamenets, which held out until the end of the war, only being ceded to Poland in 1699. Russia's early war against the Turks and the Crimeans ended in complete disaster. In 1688, Louis XIV invaded Trier in Germany, precipitating the 9 Years' War and opening a second front against the victorious Habsburgs. Fazıl Mustafa Pasha, a member of the Kapulu family and brother-in-law to Karim Mustafa, was made Grand Vizier by the new Sultan, heralding a brief return of the fortunes of the Kapulu family. He led a purge of the government and military officials accused of various corruption measures, while taking his own measures to conscript nominally loyal Muslim subjects of the empire while cracking down on desertion. Understanding that many Christians had defected to the Holy League, Fazıl Mustafa reformed the tax system to reduce the burden on Christian subjects while relaxing restrictions on the construction of new churches. Local autonomy and the power of the beys was to be counteracted by involving local nobility, ulema, and merchants in the decision-making processes of the provinces. Now, In theory, this was a short-term measure to alleviate the very much flagging Ottoman position. However, this does have the knock-on effect of decentralizing the empire as local magnates and notables, as it were, are gaining relative authority. And the actual centrally appointed bey, or the governor from Constantinople, has his own authority reduced, essentially acting as a arbiter between these various local factions. And this is going to play a major role in terms of the decentralization of the empire. But of course, this was the cost of in order for the empire to retain its provinces and to survive throughout the course of the 18th century. An uprising in Bulgaria was crushed, while the Grand Vizier moved on to Niš, the further southward Habsburger advance, and then from Niš went on to Smederevo and then Belgrade, overwhelming the Serb militias and compelling the Habsburg garrison in Belgrade to capitulate. With Belgrade back in Ottoman hands, it was thought that the Ottomans would now be in a position to retake Hungary, with the French forcing the Habsburgs to reassign their armies to the defense of Germany in the west. Linking up once again with Tokoli and the Kuros, the insurgency in Hungary, Kapruly was killed at the Battle of Slankamen and his army destroyed, leading not only to the restoration of most Habsburg gains in Hungary, but also the Habsburg conquest of Ottoman Croatia. The Ottoman Empire was left with a quick succession of sultans, Suleiman, Ahmed, Mustafa, and a series of inept viziers. Mustafa himself took to the battlefield to remedy the situation, which seemed to turn with the recapture of the island of Chios and the failure of Peter the Great's first Azov campaign. In his second campaign against the Habsburgs, Mustafa II defeated them at Aulas and Chene. Nevertheless, Azov fell the following year to Peter the Great in his second Azov campaign. Unfortunately for the Ottomans, Mustafa II's personal rule was unable to reverse the advances of the Holy League gains, which were confirmed by their victory at Zenta. Peter the Great hoped to exploit this victory to commit the League to renew their campaign. Nevertheless, by 1697, France was considered the more immediate threat to Austria, now the Turks had been pushed out of most of Hungary. At Karlovitz, the Ottomans acknowledged their losses against the Holy League, marking out the Great Turkish War as the greatest Ottoman setback since possibly the Battle of Ankara, when the forces of Bayezid Yildirim were defeated by Tamerlane. Nevertheless, it is possible that this was a much greater defeat because the Ottomans would never be able to recover these lost territories, especially with Hungary, less so when it comes to Greece and the possessions such as Azov, but especially when it comes to Hungary. Unwilling to see the Ottomans fall as a great power, Mustafa II strengthened the Temeris at the expense of the Janissaries to restore a semblance of the Sultan's absolute authority. That had more or less collapsed since the reign of Murad IV, but his ambitions were dashed when, after a failed expedition to Georgia, the Janissaries seized their moment to depose Mustafa II in an incident called the Edirne event of 1703. Despite the disaster that befell both Fazıl and Kara Mustafa Pasha, the Kapruly family had nevertheless arrested the process of decline and had been ample vice regents for the Ottoman sultans, often bereft of initiative and pets of the harem system, susceptible to domination by either the queen mother, courtesans, court eunuchs, all the factions that made Ottoman power synonymous with the idea of the port or the gate where the edicts are read from, rather than the sultan himself. Ahmed III was brought into power by the Janissaries after the deposition of Mustafa and sought to end the lawlessness and banditry that had prevailed across the empire during the war. Ahmed III did not get involved in the Spanish War of Succession to aid France. After 5 years of peace, Peter the Great declared war on the Ottomans as part of the ongoing Northern War, and for the Sultan's amnesty of Peter the Great's arch enemy, Charles XII of Sweden. The Ottomans won their first major victory at Prut, compelling a humiliated Peter the Great to return Azov to the Ottomans. After Prut, Ottoman armies under Damat Ibrahim Pasha invaded Russia. Peter was forced to abandon all of his ambitions for the Black Sea and focus on defeating Sweden and the Baltics as part of the Great Northern War. Europe was exhausted by the War of Spanish Succession, leading to the Ottomans to exploit said exhaustion, focus on the Venetians, and to recapture the Peloponnese. Now the Ottomans have recovered their position on two of the three major fronts of the Great Turkish War. The Austrians were unwilling to await an Ottoman assault into Hungary and preemptively attacked the Ottomans. Eugene of Savoy swiftly took Belgrade, and at the Treaty of Passowitz, the Ottomans conceded West Wallachia, all of Hungary and northern Serbia to the Austrians, marking the furthest ever advance of the Austrians into the Balkans until the 20th century. Ahmed's restoration had failed, and Hungary and Croatia had been lost forever. Nevertheless, the empire, despite the disasters of the early Great Turkish War, had recovered politically and economically, if not quite militarily or territorially. The reconquest of the Peloponnese and the failure of Peter's Prut campaign had demonstrated that the Ottoman Empire was still a formidable power capable of independent action. And so here we get to the first Byzantine restoration, if you will indulge my point. The era of peace and restoration would continue for the Ottomans for the next half a century, with a few notable exceptions. Damat Ibrahim Pasha was made Grand Vizier in 1718, a position he would hold for the next 12 years, during which the empire's coffers were often full and the Ottomans avoided costly military adventures. During the Prut campaign, the provinces of Moldavia and Wallachia, the Danubian principalities, whose rulers had proved unreliable and often in contact with the various enemies of the Ottomans, were placed under the control of a group called the Fanaliotes. The Fanaliotes were Greek, from the Fana, the Greek quarter of Constantinople, and the seat of the ecumenical patriarch of the Greek Orthodox Church. This term came to refer to a new class of cosmopolitan merchants and Orthodox clergymen from this district who positioned their homes in close proximity to the ecumenical patriarch. The Ottoman-recognized regent, or militebashi, nation head, essentially, of all of the subjects of the so-called Roman nation, the militirum, within the Ottoman Empire, a term which referred to all Greek Orthodox subjects under the religious jurisdiction of the new Rome of Constantinople. As the military power, or hard power, of the Ottoman Empire waned, the Porte increasingly came to rely on a clique of effective negotiators to represent the empire's interest. While the Fanariotes were ethnically Greek, their position in Constantinople and their role as traders at the nexus of the system of trade grants or capitulations to foreign powers made them natural dragomons, or interpreters, ambassadors for the Porte. Their proximity to both the Porte and the Patriarch harmonized the relations with both the Empire and the Millet, the nation of Rome, while the imperial system of the Devashurne, or the child levy, had already begun to break down among other ethnic groups, in particular the Serbs, who are now treated as fifth columnists for various militias supporting the Habsburgs. Other Muslim groups, such as the Albanians, fell out of favor after the tumult at the end of the so-called Albanian century, comprising the disproportionate influence of Albanians on the Porte until the fall of Fazil Mustafa Pasha in 1691, and we cover that more in the previous episode. The Fanaliotes thus evolved into a cosmopolitan elite, a pseudo-aristocracy operating in the world of trade, diplomacy, the church, and government. While the Fanaliotes were Greek and Orthodox, they were at pains to maintain their elite position as administrators over the former Byzantine Empire, which relied on the Sultan's good opinion. As a result, they were invariably opposed to the Greek rebels, whether it be the Klephs or the Amatoloi. Klephs literally means sort of thief in Greek, where we get the term kleptocracy, or rule of thieves. They were essentially mountain brigands who acted continuously against the Ottomans throughout Ottoman rule, in the case of the latter, as mutinous Ottoman Greek irregulars. The most prominent of the Fanariotes of the 18th century was Constantine Mavrocordatos, who essentially purchased rule over the Danubian principalities for 40 years for the Ottomans. It was during the Fanariot period in Moldavia and Wallachia they came to increasingly to imitate Habsburg and Russian methods of administration, indicating that the Fanariotes, as part of this cosmopolitan elite, were very familiar with how other nations administered their empires. Returning now briefly, if I may, to Ahmed III, the new period of Ottoman peace coincided with a new Ottoman tulip craze. A series of fires during the 1710s had led Ahmed to renovate part of Constantinople, inspired by Baroque architecture in Europe, often utilizing ornate floral motifs from tulips. gardens and pavilions were central to this new artistic craze, as exemplified by the Sadabad Palace built for Ahmed III by Ibrahim Pasha, with its marble-lined canal, landscape gardens, the Turkish response to Versailles, while Istanbul notables were encouraged for the first time to build their own residences along this canal. For the first time, the absolute system, which functions as a vortex, a series of concentric circles of immediacy toward the Sultan that indicated power via proximity, and thus the Sultan must at all times remain distant and obscured from those who were considered outside of these circles, this policy was more or less abandoned, and the idea of proximity to the Sultan, or accessibility to the Sultan, who would often wander around in his gardens, his palaces flanked by all of these new sort of villas and palaces of the tulip era architectural style. This was something which was actively encouraged. I believe this represents less the end of the system of harem or sanctity, but rather the Sultan's desire to cultivate a new elite, as demonstrated through his patronage of the Fanariotes. Ibrahim Pasha sponsored this idea of a tulip boom, and the imagery of the tulip was everywhere, from calligraphy to dressed architecture, while tulip mania led to runaway tulip inflation, and the tulip is a symbol of elite status. Something very similar happened in Holland, by the way, about a century prior to this. This was, however, no more than the zenith of the Turkish fascination with the tulip, which for them was a mystical symbol, employed long before the 18th century as an ornament during the era of the Seljuks. Mehmed II, the conqueror, is often shown with the tulip, and as a poet, covered the topic of tulips under the pseudonym Avni. Nevertheless, the very European style of absolutism, the artistic patronage and the pomp, the excess of Ahmed's magnificent court was opposed by the Albanians, not least because they had become shunted in the empire's hierarchy and the Janissaries. One particular disaffected Janissary, Patona Halil, had joined various rebellions against Ahmed III throughout the 1720s before leading a military insurrection which deposed Ahmed, killed Damat Ibrahim Pasha, and confined Ahmed to the kafes, or the gilded cage, essentially. Halil had also been joined by an ambitious Greek butcher called Yanaki, though both of them were killed shortly after the girding of the new Sultan Mahmud. The empire was once again at peace, and by the end of 1731, after a brutal purge of all of Halil and Yanaki's supporters. Mahmud's quarter-century reign saw the Ottoman Empire at war again, though this time the endurance of the Ottoman Empire as a great power was self-evident. The Persian Safavid potentate Nader Shah led an expedition against the Ottomans, which quickly confirmed Persian mastery in the Caucasus. Nader Shah exploited the success to end the old Safavid empire and begin the Afsharid dynasty. Exploiting this apparent setback, both the Austrians and the Russians declared war on the Ottomans by 1737. The Russians were able to take back Azov, but the Austrians faced disaster, losing control of Belgrade, Wallachia, and parts of the Banat to Serbia, to the Ottomans, undoing the Ottoman humiliation of the previous war against Austria. To regain Azov and once more establish a presence on the Ottoman Black Sea, the Russians had lost 100,000 men, mainly due to disease. A subsequent war against Nader Shah checked Persian expansion, and by 1747, Nader Shah, one of the greatest Iranian leaders since Shah Abbas and Shah Ismail, was assassinated, and the empire would go into decline. To put this in perspective, Nader Shah had sacked Delhi in India, destroying the power of the old Ottoman ally, the Mughal Empire. And despite all of this, he failed to win a decisive victory over the Ottomans. The rest of Mahmud's reign and that of his successor was devoted to building projects. Osman III would build the Nur al-Samani mosque here, indicated on the left, and his successor, Mustafa III, would continue in the same vein of building projects at home and promoting peace abroad, though Mustafa was an avid admirer of Frederick II of Prussia, Frederick the Great, and aimed to cultivate an anti-Austrian alliance with Prussia from 1763, with the eventual goal, in terms of his own domestic reforms, of imitating Frederick's Prussian army. While the Russians were consolidating their control over the Cossacks and expanding into the region of Circassia, Mustafa saw an opportunity to win a quick and decisive war against Russia. Right. A diplomatic consideration dating back to the reign of Ahmed III and the Great Northern War concerned Russian interference in the affairs of Poland and Lithuania. The Ottomans, during their apogee, had long benefited from Russo-Polish enmity, but the Eternal Peace had united, and this is the Eternal Peace of 1686, which we covered extensively on previous episodes if you want to check that out, had united the former enemies against their mutual enemy, the Ottomans. Now, this is quite remarkable from a perspective of Russian foreign policy, because despite their notion of being a third Muscovy or a third Rome and the patron sort of leader of the Orthodox community in the world, Russia had never taken a particularly hostile stance against the Ottoman Empire. Rather, its far more immediate threat from the middle of the 15th century until the middle of the 17th century, was always Poland and Lithuania, and to a lesser extent, Sweden. So finally, with peace achieved between the Polish and the Lithuanians, the Ottomans were now finally able to enact some sort of a historic claim and religious claim on the Ottomans. As for the Ottomans, ideally, the Ottomans would want to detach Poland from Russia. And so, when Russia came to dominate the internal affairs of Poland, the Porte feared a united power on their northern border, which would prove too difficult to defeat, threatening both Turkish domination of the Black Sea, their Crimean allies, and ultimately the security of the capital itself, Constantinople. In 1768, after Russia's victory over the Bar Confederation in Poland, Poland had become a mere Russian protectorate, but at the cost for Russia of dealing with constant rebellions. Meanwhile, the Russians under Catherine the Great had not yet recovered from their war with Prussia. Mustafa believed that he had the pretext to strike Russia at her weakest, while the Ottomans had three times as many men and a larger navy than the Russians. With French support and the rumors that Cossacks had chased Polish patriots into Ottoman territory and attacked the town of Balta, massacring its population, this is the Russian-sponsored Cossacks, Mustafa believed he was completely justified to declare war on Russia in 1768. Interestingly enough, the ally who came to Russia's support was actually Britain. Britain supported the construction of the Russian navy as a counterweight to what they saw as complete Ottoman naval domination in the Eastern Mediterranean and the Black Sea. Because the Ottoman naval power was considered so much stronger than the Russians were simply, again, supposed to deter or drain French resources and Ottoman resources in the Mediterranean. But to everyone's surprise, what everyone expected possibly to be a swift Ottoman victory, is certainly what the Ottomans expected. After an initial Crimean raid into Russia, the Ottoman fortress of Kotian quickly fell to the Russians, and soon Moldova was overrun, as was Wallachia, the Russians defeating the Ottoman army at the pivotal Battle of Kargil. Alexei Orlov, the brother of Gligely Orlov, the famous lover of Catherine the Great, led a daring raid into the Mediterranean, precipitating the Orlov Rebellion or the Maniot Rebellion all over Greece, which the Ottomans crushed with the use of irregular troops. The Russians crushed the Turkish fleet at the Battle of Chesime in 1770. I have a image here I'll quickly get up for you. It's the thumbnail for next week's episode, or rather Monday's discussion. Here we are. A battle of the use of Russian fire ships to counteract the much larger ships of the line employed by the Ottomans. Taking Constantinople was, after this great victory at Chesime, considered for the first time. Yet Catherine relented over concerns of drawing a great power coalition to oppose Russian expansion. France was already supporting the Ottomans, and the British had withdrawn from supporting the Russians, believing now that the Russians had essentially done what they wanted, and supporting the Russians any further would cause an imbalance, would actually threaten Britain. With Russia's strategy with the Maniot Rebellion, with the eruption of an anti-Ottoman revolt in Egypt, the Russian fleet launched a campaign against Ottoman positions in the Levant, occupying Beirut in what is now Lebanon twice. The Austrians now began to tentatively support the Ottomans. The downturn in Russo-Austrian relations was assuaged when Catherine accepted Frederick II's partition plan for Poland, which saw the populous region of Galicia-Lodomeria awarded to Austria as compensation for anticipated Russian conquests. After Alexander Suvorov's victory at Kozlutsa, the Ottomans finally agreed to a humiliating treaty, which confirmed Crimea as independent but really a Russian vassal. while Russia consolidated its control of Azov and Kerch, confirming a definite Russian presence on the Black Sea. Bukovina, which is a little area lodged between modern-day Ukraine and Romania, but was then part of Galicia, Lodomeria, and then detached part of Moldova, you have this tiny little region in the middle of nowhere called the Bukovina, was awarded essentially to the Austrians by the Turks as part of this desire for the Russians to acquiesce to Austria some form of compensation for their various gains. Perhaps most crucially of all, Russia was affirmed as the protector of Orthodox Christians within the Ottoman Empire, handing Catherine an easy pretext to intervene and further her expansion, the Ottoman Sultan's legitimacy within the Militarum now finally being contested. It should be noted that the Austrians were at times after the 1699 treaty, which ended the Great Turkish War, and the 1718 treaty, which ended the subsequent war, they were afforded a similar privilege, at least a titular privilege, of the idea that the Austrians were not just the protectors of Orthodox Christendom, but they were the Holy Roman Emperor was the protector of all Christians within the Ottoman Empire. Quite the reversal when under Suleiman the Magnificent, the Ottomans were demanding that the Holy Roman Emperor couldn't even use that title of emperor because there was only one Caesar and he was in Constantinople. Now, this idea, however, use in terms of a utilization by the Austrians, despite a similar privilege, is something I'm not really going to emphasize because the Austrians would seldom exploit this idea of themselves as the protector of all Christendom within the Ottoman Empire, compared to that of the Russians or even the French in the 19th century, if you know the French connection with the Maronite Christians in Syria. Now, onto the titular failed Byzantine restoration, the Greek plan or the Greek project. Mustafa III was now dead, and Abdul Hamid I was sultan, a man of religious, even an ascetic temperament. He was often called a veli or a saint, a man wary of war, a man who had spent the preceding 50 years of his life as a prisoner in the kafes or the gilded cage. He was reluctant in the extreme to launch a war of revenge against Russia, content instead to oversee gentle reforms in the military and deal with the aftermath of the revolts in Greece, Crete, Egypt, and Syria. Greece for a time returned to a state of tranquility, while the situation in Egypt began to deteriorate and became essentially an autonomous province within the empire. By contrast, the machinery of Catherine's government was designing future conquests at Ottoman expense. Catherine the Great was in some senses a postmodern ruler, perhaps one of the first postmodern rulers. A German, originally Sophia of Anhalt-Zerbst, with no claim on the Russian throne, other than through her son Paul, taking the throne when she deposed her legitimate ruler, her own husband, Peter III, and then in all likelihood used Alexei Orlov, the great admiral, to kill him. She was prepared, Catherine the Great, to present herself as a Western enlightened ruler to Voltaire, to Frederick the Great, and to the courts of Europe, let alone the Russian nobility on the one hand, and present herself as a sincerely Orthodox, Russian-speaking, Russian patriot to her subjects on the other. She was at once the centre of the Enlightenment, neoclassicism, and the earliest stirrings of a Byzantine revival, all elements that on the surface would appear contradictory, but which Catherine would utilize masterly to justify her various policies. Determined that her son Paul should never rule, when his first son Alexander came along, Catherine oversaw the raising of her grandson and preferred heir. The naming convention of Alexander had explicit political connotations that were obvious and intended for Catherine. Alexander, in the mode of the Greeks, would be a world conqueror to rival his namesake, while the association to the Macedonian conqueror was made explicit with Catherine's construction of the Pella Palace in St. Petersburg, Pella, of course, being the capital of ancient Macedonia. Her grandson, born in 1779, was called Constantine, after Constantine the Great, founder of Constantinople, whose name was shared with Constantine XI, the marble emperor, who, legend had it, never died. The body was not discovered. Rather, the body turned into stone and would, as legend would have it, animate and lead the Greeks in the restoration of Constantinople, reforging the Byzantine Empire. In full knowledge of this symbolism, none of this was lost on Catherine or her lover and military strongman, Grigory Potemkin, who had fought in the First War against the Ottomans. A medal was struck to celebrate the birth of Constantine, with the inscription, "Back to Byzantium." According to the British ambassador to St. Petersburg, Prince Potemkin's mind is constantly taken up with the idea of creating an empire in the East. He has managed to fascinate the Empress with these feelings, and she proves so subject to his chimeras that she christened the newborn Grand Prince Constantine, gave him a nursemaid, a Greek, by the name of Helen, and talks in her own circles about how to place him on the throne of the Eastern Empire. At the same time, she's setting up a town at Tsarskoye Selo to be called Konstantinogorod, essentially the city of Constantine. The Crimea was finally annexed to Russia in 1783, and with it, Russia received its ancient Greek population, with their links not only to ancient Greece, but Byzantium, as the former denizens of the Peritheia, the overseas dominion of the Empire of Trebizond. In a further connection, the Phanariotes were not natives of Constantinople at all. Most had been killed or expelled by Mehmed II in 1453. Rather, the Phanariotes were a settled community, imported into Constantinople in 1463, following Mehmed's conquest of the Empire of Trebizond. The Phanariotes and the Pontic Greeks of the Crimea thus had a cultural and ethnic link beyond being simply Greeks. Moreover, Greeks in the Ottoman Empire, after the failure of the Orlov Revolt, were invited to settle in Russia. John Varvakis and much later John Kapistras, both heroes of Greek independence, were key examples of this. Combine this strategy with Catherine's new status as with Catherine's new status as defender of Eastern Christendom, and all of a sudden, the Phanariotes, who had administered the Byzantine portion of the Ottoman Empire, now posed an existential threat, an administrative apparatus that could collaborate with a Russian-backed restoration in Constantinople. The Phanariot administration in the Danubian principalities, most of all now, represented a threat to the Ottoman Porte due to their proximity to Russia, their relative autonomy, and their ability to defect. While many of the Phanariotes were indifferent to such schemes by Russia and rebuked the notion that they were now Russian fifth colonists, they were forced to offer huge concessions of assets and tribute to the Porte to retain their positions as an elite within the Militarum. Returning to the Crimea and Russia's recent conquests at Ottoman expense, Catherine the Great decided to establish a new city for the Crimean Greeks in Mariupol and Donetsk, whose populations were soon augmented by Rufines and Germans. As with establishing the province of New Russia in anticipation of Russian gains prior to the war, after the war, the naming convention of Russian towns made the association between Eastern Rome, ancient Greece, explicit. Curzon was founded in 1778 after the Greek colony of Chalonsonsos, which at times had been the centre of the whole Roman administration in the Crimea, or the ancient name Taurida. Yevpatoria after Mithridates the Great of Pontus, Melitopol after Melita, and Sevastopol after the Greek term of Sebasta, Sebastokrator, roughly analogous to that of Augustus. Potemkin moved to Crimea and established his own southern court as the Prince of Taurida and the governor of the Russian south, where he crushed the lingering elements of Cossack resistance. It should be noted, actually, that Potemkin's court in the south was said to rival Catherine the Great's court in St. Petersburg, and Catherine the Great would often deride Peter the Great as having failed to exploit the fact of setting up a capital city on the warm banks of the Black Sea, as opposed to chilly St. Petersburg in the extreme north. Potemkin presented his new colony, New Russia, to the world, yet the construction of these new cities was not as successful as he intimated, a Katerinoslav, or Glory of Catherine, being one such case. In the extreme, his name would be synonymous with the idea of the Potemkin village, stage-managed sets, essentially, presented to foreigners to give the impression of Russian prosperity and progress, though these allegations of fraud, which were prevalent during the Crimean expedition of Joseph II and of Catherine the Great, had been wildly exaggerated, as was noted by various Austrian contemporaries who were actually there. Nevertheless, by 1782, the population of Novorossiya, New Russia, had doubled, and Potemkin had succeeded in the construction of the Black Sea Fleet, placing Russia's naval footing in the span of only 2 decades on the same footing of Spain, which before the Napoleonic invasions, Spain was considered, and before the Battle of Trafalgar, Spain was considered one of the greatest naval powers in the world and still possessed its empire. The construction of a navy and the conscious naming conventions of the towns and the name of Constantine himself betray the true purpose of this effort by Catherine and Potemkin to not only eclipse Peter the Great and St. Petersburg in the north, but to facilitate this idea of Novorossiya as a bridgehead for further expansion, if not the ruin of the Ottoman Empire, Potemkin's Greek plan. Catherine the Great had learned quickly from the First War of the dangers of coalitions and sought to placate and involve the great powers in the scheme for a renewed Byzantine Empire. A Greek-led state intended for Constantine either as a Russian ally or more likely as a Russian protectorate. Potemkin would be awarded control over the Danubian principalities. On this map here, you can see on the left the suggestion of a partition plan. The idea for Potemkin was to give him control of this idea of the Danubian principalities as a new Dacia, which of course is referring again to the ancient Roman state of Dacia, which had been a series of tribes before them. I have my own little theory on this, as opposed to why Potemkin was awarded his own principality. It's a possibility that if Potemkin was raised to, say, for example, king of Dacia, he would have been considered a sovereign and an equal, and been finally married to, finally able to acknowledge his marriage to Catherine the Great. Nevertheless, I still think that's an interesting theory, but it's rather dubious because Catherine the Great would seldom ever want to share power. So whilst Potemkin would be rewarded with this idea of the Danubian principalities, Joseph II of Austria, as a key ally, would need to be induced, as he had the most to lose in a Russian takeover of the Ottoman Empire. And so the Greek plan quickly evolved into a partition plan, stating Austria and Venice over their traditional claims in the region. Venice would get the Morea, and the Austrians would get Bosnia, and they would also get Serbia, so northern Serbia, Bosnia. And as you can see on this map, Albania is also included as part of this original partition plan. In 1787, the courts of both Joseph II and Catherine the Great journeyed into the Crimea, arranged by Potemkin, to the awe of the to all the Austrians with Russia's power, including fireworks displays and a full-scale reenactment of the Battle of Poltava, to finally induce them into an aggressive alliance against the Ottomans. And this effort, it should be stated, was indeed successful, inducing the alliance, I mean. All of these actions the Ottomans rightly interpreted as provocations and violations of the peace treaty they had signed in 1774. The Russians responded to the Ottoman ultimatum to relinquish Crimea by declaring war. The Ottomans were now the weaker force in 1787 compared to 1768 and were not expected to survive a joint Russo-Austrian offensive. An Ottoman seaborne invasion of Crimea failed, and soon Potemkin and Suvorov were leading an offensive, taking Ochakov at the mouth of the Dnieper, just further on from Kherson. On the Russian front, the Ottomans had been pushed back into Moldova, and the Russians were victorious at the battles of Foksani, Rimnik, Manchin, and at the siege of Ismail at the mouth of the Danube. After Ismail, Suvorov marched to Constantinople, but the expected rebellion against the Ottomans never materialized, nor did another revolt in Greece lead to a collapse of Ottoman rule in the provinces. It didn't help that Suvorov, despite his undefeated status, marked the entry of every new town by massacring the civilian population, Ochakov being the worst instance of this. Meanwhile, Austrian help was providing more of a hindrance than a real help, as the Ottomans actually found some success in their campaign in Croatia, Serbia, and Hungary. All in all, anticipated Ottoman collapse after nearly a decade of Russian preparation had not amounted to fulfillment of the Greek plan, but rather minor territorial gains and the recognition of Russia's existing claims now advanced to the River Dniester. Austria gained nothing from this. The Russians were quick to pursue peace with the double prospect of a Prussian intervention on the side of Turkey and the collapse of Russian influence in Poland as the Patriots were back in power and Poland would finally witness its second and third partitions, ending Polish statehood in 1795. The Greek plan was put on hold indefinitely. The French Revolution may at first facilitated the prospect of this plan, as the Ottomans were now deprived of their principal material backer. Nevertheless, the French would quickly prove to be a much greater threat to Russia over the ensuing decades. Catherine the Great died in 1796, while Selim III, Sultan since 1789, became convinced of the need to reform the army and westernize the Ottoman Empire, having been spared dissolution with the Treaty of Jassy in 1792. The Ottoman Empire was survived, essentially, but it was still under attack. the Ottoman Empire's tentative reform process and viability as a power was soon after tested from an entirely different direction, an albeit unexpected direction, attacked by its former ally France. In 1798, Napoleon suggested an expedition to Egypt as part of the ensuing conflict with essentially everyone in Europe, but most importantly Britain, appealing to the French revolutionary government that doing so would harm British trade in the Mediterranean and India. In fact, that Egypt was technically part of the Ottoman Empire was of secondary importance to Napoleon Bonaparte. French traders were already there claiming harassment, and the local Mamluk elite, which would rule the province with relative impunity after rebellions of the 1770s. The French government had little hope for success and took the opportunity to potentially get rid of a popular general and a political threat. Of course, we all know how that turned out for the French government. In the event, Napoleon Bonaparte was at first victorious in the Battle of the Pyramids before facing down a revolt in Cairo and leading expeditions into Syria. Though, as the attack had essentially begun as a proxy war against the British, the Royal Navy interceded to support the Ottoman Empire, destroying the French fleet at the Battle of the Nile. Napoleon fled from Egypt in 1799 and would later launch a coup and become first consul and then emperor of the French. And the conflict between France and the Ottomans was resolved in Ottoman favour in 1801. The French had essentially gained nothing. And Napoleon would later justify the success of this expedition as essentially a fact-finding mission, the birth of Egyptology. It was the scientific expertise which were more important than the actual strategic gains, which for France, you know, France just lost an army. In terms of like the implications of this, in terms of great power politics, this sets off the next 70 years of Anglo-French rivalry for control and influence over the rump, which is Egypt, as nominally part of the Ottoman Empire. The war had, moreover, demonstrated how the Ottoman centre had lost control of the periphery. In the case of Egypt, this was never regained. To reverse this trend and reassert central control, Selim began importing Western military advisors to oversee the construction of the Nizam-i Jadid, which essentially means the New Order Army. For all intents and purposes, as demonstrated with the Fanariots in the bureaucratic administration, the Devachani child levy system was over, as the New Order Army was now comprised of Turkish peasants to be used against the Yanisheris. Right, excuse me. Here we are. Oh. The Ottoman Empire survived into the 18th century, And as you can see, with most of its territory intact, save for the interesting case of Montenegro, if you indulge my diversion for a moment, the state of Montenegro had never been effectively governed by the Ottomans and would come to be ruled by metropolitans. It was called a prince bishopric, essentially. The metropolitans of the older Montenegrin capital of Senici. They first received various Venetian support and then Russian support after 1715 under their metropolitan Danilo, and their independence was finally recognized by the Ottomans in 1789. But I wouldn't put that much significance in terms of the Ottoman recognition of a new state in the Balkans, because unlike the Serbian Revolution, this was more a recognition that Montenegro had essentially never been under effective Ottoman control. Nevertheless, the preservation of most of the empire's territory, in a sense, is remarkable, as the empire faced off against nearly every European major power, often in tandem, and in the case of Russia, with designs on the end of the empire and the recapture of Constantinople, and if not the end of the empire, at least the Ottoman Empire being removed from Europe. The Greek plan failed, and with the benefit of hindsight, Russia would never be in a position or of opportunity to bring about the Byzantine Empire again, as compared with the Crimean War and the First World War. Yet as we enter the 19th century, it has become clear that the Ottoman Empire is no longer the supreme power it was considered in 1683. Now it is a receding power, often saved as part of great power political contrivance to maintain the European balance of power. This will become an ever more enduring fact of the 19th century and will become part of something known as the Eastern Question. Now more than ever, there is a fundamental weakness to being a multi-ethnic, multi-religious empire surrounded by vultures, claiming some ownership or patronage over various groups. The Greeks rose in revolt continuously from 1685 until 1792, and yet the Greek elite, the Fanariots, remained nominally loyal to the Ottoman Porte. Nevertheless, the Russian-Greek link established by Catherine the Great had been sown essentially to presage Greek independence further down the line, as with the collapse of central authority in Egypt and the implications of that for the future of Greece and the Ottomans. Moreover, I have hinted at the French Revolution and the implications of that for the Ottomans, which will come to mean the rise of nationalism, and we'll see that most evident with Serbia when we retread this topic again, which, though ironically, it would weaken the Ottoman Empire, it would also doom any serious possibility of a Byzantine restoration that was anything more than enlarged Greece. When we talk, therefore, of a failed Byzantine restoration, my meaning, I hope you can understand, is multifaceted. There was a Byzantine restoration in that from 1711 until 1768, the Militarum, the nation of Rome, was at its zenith in terms of it acting as a fundamental administrative structure within the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Porte was dependent on the empire's Byzantine character, the Patriarch, the Phanaliots, and their role as dragomon, or the interpreters of the West, for internal peace and the empire's international soft power. This Byzantification of the empire ironically began failing as soon as Russia began advocating for its own Byzantine restoration under its own auspices and under a Romanov emperor. And this would have been Constantine. For a brief moment in time, the Russians, had they exploited it effectively, could have utilized the Phanaliots, the elite of the Roman nation, to spearhead the creation of a Neo-Byzantium. Instead, the Russians failed. The nation of Rum would break, becoming, over the course of the 19th century, the nations of Greece, Montenegro, Serbia, Bulgaria, and so on, while Constantinople would remain, and is still today, Turkish. Right, I hope you enjoyed the lecture. I haven't seen any super chats, but if there are any questions, do start now. I'll try and get to the end here. Were there any super chats? I mean, you've got me for about 15 minutes or so. So if no one's going to ask me any questions or send me a super chat, so I'll just get out of here. Right. Okay, I have to zoom up and see if anyone said anything interesting. Okay, I can't really see anything apart from a reference to the Latin Empire, which is going back to the 13th century. John Hawkins just sends a £2 super sticker. I can't see where your super sticker is from this angle. I'll try and see if I can get it back on here. Oh, it's a funny little thing saying, a little creature saying cool. Well, thank you very much, John Hawkins. Lost for words, £5, just sends another little creature. So thank you very much. You really are lost for words. I can't remember if you've actually ever sent me a question as a super chat lost for words, but regardless, thank you very much. Right, an actual question. John Gordon for $9.99. Thank you very much. What factor contributed the most to Ottoman decline, in your opinion? Oh, goodness. Well, as I've been at sort of pains to explain, I think I find Ottoman sort of survival remarkable in the fact that it began as a conquest state, in complete contrast to, the, say, for example, the Poland-Lithuania, or Russia, or Austria-Hungary, or later become Austria-Hungary, but now is historiographically referred to as the Habsburg monarchy. All of these states have some sort of, you know, historical connection, whether it be, you know, as a union of various states through marriage or through election, as the case with the Habsburg monarchy, a willing union between two powers against a mortal enemy, in the case of Poland-Lithuania, or in the case of Russia, a reconsolidated state united behind an orthodox identity and this idea of unifying the Eastern Slavs. But in the case of the Ottomans had none of this, and they they enslaved and utilized the whole sort of peoples of the Balkans as part of the Devershane for such a long period. And by this time, ironically, by the 18th century, they had survived the 18th century by cultivating the Fenaliots and making the empire relatively more Greek, ironically empowering the same faction who would be the intellectual sort of force behind Greek independence. But nevertheless, I think they are still sort of Byzantine in the sense that they are supporting the nation of Rome whilst the Roman Empire exists. And I do believe the Russians hoped that they would service them as a effective Byzantine bureaucracy. That's why I find the Fenaliots rather fascinating in the sense is that they do occupy this privileged position as a Byzantine, thoroughly Byzantine elite, international, you know, religious, economic elite. In terms of the overall factor that sort of amounted to Ottoman decline, the Ottomans therefore had a inexorable weakness in that sense. And as the Ottoman Empire declined militarily, the other nations could exploit this division between the religious communities, the ethnic communities, at the expense of the empire. There's probably one factor which I need to emphasize is that the Ottoman Empire seldom had any good sultans after Suleiman the Magnificent. They were all middling to average. Apart from Devlet Ibrahim Pasha, Ahmed's grand vizier, who ran the empire from 1718 to 1730, the empire was often beset with, you know, vast amounts of men, supplies, but incompetent military leadership, in complete contrast to the previous state of the empire. There's also the factor to consider that the empire was relatively technologically backward compared to the West. For example, the printing press was only really introduced with with the inception of the Tulip period between 1718 and 1730. So there were many factors as opposed to one sort of overriding factor. I can't really say. I mean, the Ottoman Empire is an anomaly in the great sort of European power structure. And it is incredible to me that it survives throughout the course of the 18th century relatively intact. However, there is one important consideration which this map here doesn't tell the true story. Because if you look at this, if I actually able to put my mouse over this and change this, if you look at this map, 1683, and you look at this map, 1801, save for Hungary and Crimea, very little has actually changed. In fact, this map isn't entirely accurate in terms of the actual sort of definition of autonomy within this territory. Because according to this map, the Ottomans have actually gained in Yemen, they've also gained in Libya. However, I believe that this doesn't sort of represent the true story, which is that as a result of the Great Turkish War, and as a result of the power which Beys wielded that could potentially threaten the center, the Ottoman Empire directly empowered local elites. And as a result of that, the peripheral territories began to move further and further and further away from the Sublime Porte in Constantinople. So much so that when we look at the Egyptians throughout the course of the 19th century, during the 1840s, the Egyptians controlled half of the Ottoman Empire. They controlled Hejaz, they controlled Syria, they controlled Egypt, all nominally as Ottoman vassals. So, whilst the technical territories of the Ottoman Empire look quite impressive, within this territory, we're seeing increasing decentralization, political fragmentation, constant rebellions, which are only slowly put down. And we see, of course, the constant use of Ottoman irregular forces to put down the rebellions. And, of course, this will flare up repeatedly when we talk about great power interventions and this idea of the ongoing Eastern question. Judge Killigley Bushman for 10 euros, thank you very much. Is there any truth to the Western betrayal considering giving up Constantinople in 1918? If you mean giving up Constantinople, I mean, there were lots of plans. I mean, one of the first suggestions during the First World War was that Constantinople be given to the Russians. I don't believe, I believe that was just a chimera to keep the Russians going in the war I don't believe the British would have ever given the Russians Constantinople unless the Russians took it from Britain's cold, dead hands, which, looking at the state of the Russian Empire in 1917, was never going to happen. In terms of giving over Constantinople to the Greeks, I believe what Britain's primary strategy was to declare Constantinople an international city, which would essentially mean that Constantinople would be controlled by the British, ostensibly leading an international force, thereby giving the British controls of the Bosphorus Straits. However, it would also give Britain control over, from 1922, the Ottoman Sultan, or from 1920 until 1924, Abdul Chimid, who was the Ottoman, the last caliph, the last caliph of the Ottoman Empire. And the significance of the British essentially holding the caliph of the Muslims captured is that they could essentially use him as some sort of conduit to influence Muslim Sunni Islamic politics throughout not just the British Empire, but throughout the rest of the world. So I don't believe the British would have ever allowed repatriation of Constantinople to Greece unless it was part of, you know, this general winding down of the British Empire, which you see especially in the latter half of the 20th century. But of course, in the end, it was a moot point because Constantinople was essentially given up to the Turks to essentially present them, essentially Ataturk presented the Greeks with a military fait accompli, and the British were not prepared to fight to defend Constantinople after the First World War. So Western betrayal, British betrayal, that's a constant feature of our foreign policy, Judge Caligula Bushman. So basically diversity got apostolic imagined. Well, just do bear in mind that the Ottoman Empire was able to hold on together until it was, you know, militarily defeated on all sides continuously for centuries. So it's not as simple as just saying it's diversity. That's why I find the Ottoman Empire endlessly fascinating, and how I've tried to segue it into this idea of the series of orthodoxy, autocracy, and nationality, talking about the Byzantine restoration that never was, the collapse of the Milite Rum, and the failure of the Greek plan of the Russians. Aldous Oscar for £5. Were the other Islamic powers offering any help to the Ottomans? In the 18th century, well, traditionally, the Ottoman Empire was considered the leading state of all Sunni Muslims because they were the Caliph. However, their biggest rival, probably even a greater military threat for most of their history than Austria or the Russians, were the Persians. And because the Persians were Shia Islam, but also because they had territorial claims on Iraq and Eastern Armenia, the Caucasus in general, it was very unlikely that the Ottomans, the Persians, were ever going to come to this long-lasting peace. Even though they were able to clarify their borders on multiple occasions. So the Persians would have done everything to accelerate Ottoman decline, not assist in their support. And as a result of this, the main Muslim ally for the Ottoman Empire throughout most of its history was the Mughal Empire. But as discussed in this lecture, the Mughal Empire began collapsing after the death of Aurangzeb in 1707. And in the 17th, I can't remember exactly what year, but sometime in the 1730s or 1740s, Nader Shah destroyed the city of Delhi, more or less dooming the Mughal Empire to exist as a city-state compared to a state which nearly unified the entire Indian subcontinent. So with that, the Ottoman Empire loses its greatest Sunni ally. And again, what are the implications if the Mughal Empire had held on? Could it have militarily supported the Ottomans? Could it have resisted the British colonization of India? All of these interesting questions. Of course, then we'll be indulging in alternative history then. As for the lesser Ottoman powers, as you can see on this map, the Ottomans have basically assimilated all of the would-be Ottoman, all of the would-be Islamic powers that matter. They control Egypt, they control Turkey, they control the populated parts of Arabia. They don't control places like Oman, which had their own sect of Islam. And they actually, during this time, controlled substantial parts of the eastern coast of Africa. But they also control Tunisia and they also control Algeria. But all of these territories will be shorn off and occupied piecemeal throughout the course of the 19th century. So yes, I hope that answers your question. Right. Bolodinus. No, it's not that the printing press was banned. It was that the printing press wasn't introduced from above, essentially. It wasn't patronized by the Ottoman elite until the 1720s, whereas the printing press in the West had been patronized since the beginning of the 16th century. That's the fundamental point to denote here. Right. They would also control three entries into the Mediterranean. Are you talking about the British Empire? Because, yeah, they would control all entries into the Mediterranean. They would control Gibraltar. They would control Suez, and they would control the Bosphorus Straits. And, of course, it was probably rather short-sighted of Britain to concede Constantinople, Istanbul, back to Ataturk, because Ataturk prevaricated when it came to dealing with the Soviet Union. If anything, the Soviet Union and Ataturk were natural allies during the 1920s, which is all the more remarkable. So especially for British foreign policy in the 1920s, I think the prestige associated with holding Constantinople would have been interesting. But then again, there are the implications that had Britain held on to Constantinople, the Greeks would have hated them. You know, talk about, you know, compare the incident with the Elgin marbles and compare it with holding on to Constantinople. I think the Greeks would passionately hate us far more. Right. Okay. Diversity was their strength. No. I'm trying to make the point that it succeeded in spite of diversity. So you can't look at their diversity as a fundamental flaw until it begins actually dividing up the empire in the 19th century. Why do you think the financial state of the Ottoman Empire began to decline in the 1800s? I don't believe the Ottoman Empire ever had a good state, a good financial system. One of the most remarkable things about the Ottoman Empire is that, you know, when looking at somewhere like the Chinese Empire, the Qing Dynasty in the 19th century, the Qing Dynasty had more or less a closed economy. They operated, and the same with Tokugawa, Japan. They operated all trade through treaty ports. In China, it was Macau. In China, it was Canton, and in Japan, it was Nagasaki. And this way, they could have a control of trade. However, ever since the Ottoman Empire inherited something called the capitulations, whereby foreigners were given extraterritoriality and they were allowed to, foreigners were essentially allowed, you know, to trade with impunity, and they weren't going to be tried by foreign courts. This was something the Ottomans inherited, and this is something the Ottomans were very skeptical to do away with, because it essentially guaranteed some form of incentive of Christian merchants to continue on trading within the Ottoman Empire by giving these incentives called the capitulations. The capitulations were originally granted to the Venetians, then they were granted to the French, making it essentially so that the Ottoman Empire had essentially been controlled. Its trade and its economy was essentially free market to its own detriment. It was the opposite of mercantilism in the Ottoman Empire. And of course, this system, therefore, very easily lent into a system where the British basically controlled the financial system of the Ottoman Empire towards the end of the 19th century. So the Ottoman Empire was never in a particularly good state financially. Okay. TB88. Persia seems to always be in conflict with whosoever controls that territory, whether Rome or Sunni is. Yes, if you look at the borders, this is the borders of the Ottoman Empire here are the equivalent of the furthest eastern extent of the Roman Empire under Trajan. So yes, essentially the conflicts between Parthia and the Roman Empire, or Sasanian. So this is at the House of Sasan against the Ottoman Empire, against the Roman Empire, or the Umayyad and later the Abbasid Caliphates against the Byzantine Empire, and later the Persians and the Ottomans. No, it's almost constant. This control, this line over who controls Mesopotamia, whether to draw our line here east of the east of the sort of Straits of Basra, or we're going to draw it the bank of Euphrates, you know, on the borders of Syria. It's a constant. Again, it's not so much, you know, ideological. Of course, the Romans were Christian ultimately, and the Sasanians were Zoroastrian. So there were ideological components which informed that conflict, and later it would become Christian and Islamic, and then later Sunni and Shia. And this is something that still exists today, as you know, with the Iran-Iraq war, as you just mentioned in the chat, TB88. Bolodenes has asked me, when did the Roman identity get replaced by the local postmodern ones, such as Greek? Well, I don't really want to ruin that, because that's going to be the concept for next week's, not next week, whenever we're going to come back to this, which is probably in about 6 weeks. That'll be the content for the Greek War of Independence, when we're talking about when Byzantine identity became Greek identity. Because it's definitely not apparent to me here, which is why I talk about this idea of a failed Byzantine restoration. Is the Greek mindset, the term Roman, synonymous with the term Greek? No. The term Roman in Greek is Romaioi. And this is how the Greeks refer to themselves, and the Westerners refer to themselves while the Byzantine Empire was in existence, as the Empire of the Greeks. Whereas they refer to themselves as Romaioi, they would not refer to themselves as Greeks for two reasons. One, they did not think of themselves as a Greek nation state. They considered themselves as the Eastern Roman Empire, one. Two is that the connotations of Greeks were with the ancient Greeks, the Hellas, the Hellenes, who were explicitly pagan. So there was a religious reason, and there was a reason of prestige and civilizational prestige as to why the Greeks would have balked at the idea of using the term Greeks until the 19th century, when we see the Greek War of Independence. And they very much, when we look at Catherine the Great's conception, and Catherine the Great is the most in terms of this idea of a neo-Byzantine empire, she very much associates Greece and Rome as virtually synonymous, even though, you know, she's referring both to ancient Greece and to the Byzantine Empire. Victor Vasquez, why did the financial state of the Ottoman Empire decline in the 1800s and impede their modernization efforts? I'm hesitating to thank you for the super chat. I'm hesitant to answer that question simply because chronologically we've stopped at 1801. So any sort of, because that's a very sort of expansive question, and it's something I hesitate to answer without doing my research into the 19th century. In terms of general sort of methods to impede their modernization efforts, why did the financial state of the Ottoman, well, like I've said, there was never in a particularly good state. The Ottoman Empire was always in need of money. I think the remarkable thing about reading about the 18th century is how relatively healthy the coffers were, how competent the central administration was, at least, and how the empire was able to, for the most part, pay their Yanisheris, and except for the occasional sort of disgruntled Yanisheri. But I mean, the Ottoman Empire, despite all the odds, was actually, I would say, at least superficially, rather successful in its modernization efforts in the 1800s, in some senses. I mean, the empire underwent a clothing reform in the 1830s. It was able to destroy the Yanisheris and create a modern army. You have Tanzimat, you have, albeit that was, again, a rather controversial within the Ottoman Empire. You have the creation of some form of, you know, modern-ish Ottoman navy. And, you know, the Ottoman Empire held on with most of its territory in Europe until 1912. And no one expected the Ottoman Empire to lose so quickly. And it was the Italo-Turkish War in 1911 which finally convinced everyone in the Balkans, at least, that the Ottoman Empire was essentially ripe for the picking, weak, the modernization effort had failed, and we can just move in and we can divvy up the Balkans between ourselves, which is what happened between 1912 and 1913. As for how the specific implications of how the financial state would impede their modernization efforts, if you mean modernization efforts in terms of creating a sovereign state, a sovereign self-sufficient state with a competent army and a competent navy that could resist, you know, the Russians on their own and reassert some sort of control over the Balkans, I'd think even with a competent state of financial administration, I think that was a very tall order to manage. Histriophile has asked, why is the Ottoman frontier the same as Trajan's frontier? Is there a physical or demographic feature that makes that frontier unlikely? Well, considering the demographics of 1801, you know, when did the empire get, okay, Suleiman the Magnificent establishes that boundary. Considering the demographics in 1555 were very different from the demographics in 117, I don't think it was a demographic reason. If you look at the demographics now of that region, which would have been very similar during the time of Suleiman the Magnificent, you have Shias in the Ottoman side, you have Kurds crossing over from the Ottoman side into Iran, you have Armenians who are also crossing over that border, because this border is using superimposing modern borders. Do I have a better map than this to try and illustrate my point? Not really. But anyway, the Ottoman Empire with its Persian border in the east, the Persians went further north, so they partitioned Armenia between them. And also there was a significant, so while there were essentially, you know, Shiite populations in the Ottoman section, there were also Arabs in Khuzestan. So demographically, it's just a complete mess in terms of demarcating a border there, as opposed to the ethnics. I mean, I actually don't know enough about the ethnic continuity between the peoples of Mesopotamia and the Persian Iranian populations and the Aramaic, the Semitic populations occupying that region in the 2nd century compared to now, I'm afraid. As to why physical features, that region is incredibly mountainous, which means that essentially you have the Zagros Mountains in Iran, which act as some form of natural defense, and then you have the Armenian Highlands as well. So this creates some form of natural border, which is somewhat advantageous to the Persians, Iranians, but also it means that the Iranians have conceded the loss of a vast amount of territory, which was originally theirs, which was Mesopotamia and Western Armenia. So there were pros and cons for the Iranians moving so far to the east. But even despite that, even despite the fact that there were some natural advantages to holding that territory, the Ottomans would routinely occupy the sometime capital of the Persian Empire in Tabriz, which is part of historic Azerbaijan, but not part of the modern state of Azerbaijan. Many reasons as to why that border's there, but definitely not demographic. Fun fact, the Romans all went to Romania. Yep. Turks are just gay Mongols. No. True Roman culture is stealing wallets and copper wire. Okay. Johannes Paleologos is mentioning my point about natural borders. So, right, I think that's enough for me this evening, if that's all right with you. Right, thank you everyone for sending the super chats. Another point to mention is that on Monday there will be a discussion with Furious Pertinax and Columba going over various aspects of this. Unfortunately, Semagog is in the process of moving at the moment, so he's unavailable. I think there was also a bit of crosswires about organizing this as well. But Columba and Pertinax will be joining us for that stream. So I hope you enjoy it. other than that, there were quite a few viewers on my Ukraine video. So if I do have any new audience members coming in and watching this, hello, welcome. You're very much appreciated your presence here. Thank you very much for joining this live stream. Thank you all very much again for watching, and good night.